Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph. The Mishnah says, "Emeniach pirot liot mafrish lehem truma umasrot maot liot mafrish lehem maasir sheni mafrish lehem bechazkat shehin kayamin." Here we have in the Mishnah a similar genre of halacha that we've seen in the previous Mishnayot, which is that a person that's engaged in a certain activity, or we have a certain assumption that is there, that assumption continues to be true, and we assume there is a chazakah for that assumption. In this case, an individual set aside fruits to use in the future as his trumot and masrot. And that is that he designates whether it's a barrel of wine, whether it's oil or other produce that he sets aside. And then as he goes along, he is mafrish or uses these items to be the truma, the maser, upon other items or produce that he has. And the same thing with monies that he uses to redeem his maaser sheni. He set aside those monies. And then he continues to use those monies until, of course, he's utilized all of them. But he can work with an assumption that is the case with the chazaka is that way. And he doesn't have to assume that anything has changed from the status quo that he has left behind. Im avdu, if they are lost, there is a choshesh me'et le'et. If they are lost or if the monies are lost. Now here, it's not that they have rotted or there's something missing there, because then we could do a calculation, an assumption of what would have been the normal deterioration rate of those items, and then we could figure out how long this has been going on or how far back we should look retroactively to assume that there is a problem here. But here, imabdu means that they were stolen, lost, they are completely gone, and therefore we have no way to assess what type of deterioration happened or the period of time at which it deteriorated. There are alternate girses in the Mishnah that say Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua, but that we worry for 24 hours retroactively that this did not happen immediately, but happened rather within the period of 24 hours leading up until the point that he realizes or is made aware of the fact that they are missing. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, b'shlosha prakim bodkim et ha'yayin, three times during the year a person has to check the wine. This seemingly is connected to the previous part of the Mishnah, whereby someone left a barrel of wine to use to separate out his trumot and masrot, and the wine can turn into vinegar. It can go bad over time. And therefore, you have to check to ensure that it's still wine, because one may not be mafrish from items that are of not similar type when it comes to trumot and masrot. And therefore, if the wine is no longer wine but vinegar, he cannot utilize that for his trumot and masrot on other wine that he has. So three times a year, he should check the wine, because that is the general periods of time where these problems arise. And if a person checks during those periods, he'll know for certain that it still remains wine. Bikidum shel motzei chag, immediately after Sukkot, ubahotzat smadar, at the time that the blossom drops from the tree and the fruit begins to emerge, ubashat knisat mayim beboser, by the time that the water enters into the boser. Rashi here brings two different interpretations as to what this is, the first of which is favored by the majority of the Rishonim, which is kashahen kapula lavan, when it's the size of a white bean, that's when it's called a boser. And then, when some liquid enters into the grape at that time and grows within it, to the point where if you squeeze the grape at that time, you would get liquid out of it, that is the time that's called knisat mayim lebuser. On the other hand, Rashi brings an alternate view, which is this has to do with grapes or immature grapes that are squeezed, and then you put water into them to mix them and to make them into a vinegar dip. That's what's referred to the knisat mayim, or the lachluchut ha-mayim that goes into the grapes. Again, the first interpretation of Rashi is favored by the majority of the Rishonim. What's interesting about this Mishnah that Tosafot already raises is the fact that we just learned that one is not allowed to be mafrish shelo min ha-mukaf, that the only way that you're allowed to be mafrish trumot ha-masrot is when they are adjacent to each other. So how come in this Mishnah we're talking about a person who is seemingly taking off trumot ha-masrot, not connected to the particular item, because he doesn't see it, and that's why there's this possibility that he needs to use the chazak, or the possibility that it went bad, and therefore he has a problem. So Tosafot here answers that these are extenuating circumstances. For instance, it's a case when we're going into Arve Shabbatot v'Yom Tov. He's entering to Shabbat and Yom Tov, and he's under pressure to be mafrish the trumot and masrot. In those cases, we waive the need for mukaf in order that he can be mafrish before Shabbat and Yom Tov. So for the Onek HaShabbat, or the Simchat HaYom Tov, we allow him to do this, Shalom Min HaMukaf. Others discuss, based on what we said yesterday, that this case in the Mishnah might be referencing Trumat Ma'aser, And Trumat Maaser, as we saw in yesterday's daf, many of the Rishonim believe does not have an obligation of Mina Mukaf. Despite the fact that the Gemara asks the question, it may only be either Derabanan that Mina Mukaf, or if you hold the Rashi, who says that the reason for Mina Mukaf is that you just have to be able to see it, that it's still there. In our case, that would not necessarily relieve us of the problem, because it's a possibility that he sees it's there, but the barrel that has the wine in it might be vinegar already. So even though it's Mina Mukaf, quote-unquote, according to Rashi Shita, it still could have the problems that are introduced in our Mishnah. Still others believe that Trumat Maser does not require Mukaf whatsoever, and that's either, as we said yesterday, a Chumer de Rabbanan, or something that the Chavirim did. And in that way, they explain our Mishnah as being a case of Masrot, which don't require Mina Mukaf, and Trumat Maser, rather than plain Truma, which also doesn't have a requirement of Mina Mukaf. Again, Tosafot, believing that it is a Gzeret HaKatuv and there is a necessity for Mina Mukaf by Trumat Maser, says this is an extenuating circumstance in which he did not have to do Mina Mukaf. And even though our Mishnah seems to go against what we learned by Lokeach Yaimi Ben HaKutim, there where the Tanaim are Choshesh for the fact that Shema Yibaka Nod, and therefore they don't want you to be Mafrish Trumot Masrot in arrears retroactively because of that fear, over here, it seems that our Mishnah indicates that they are done b'chazkat shehen kayamin, which is in contrast to what we said by lo yokeach yaimi ben akutim. The way to reconcile that is the same way that the Gemara reconciled it before, that there's a difference between shema yamut and shema meit. It's a difference between whether someone, or we're choshesh for the fact that someone will die in the future, which we are choshesh for, versus shema meit, whether we're choshesh that the person has already passed away, which we're not choshesh for. And similarly over here, Shema Yibaka node is equivalent to Shema Yamut, that the node will break in the future, or something might happen to the future, that we are Choshesh for. Shema Bakaha node, that the flask or whatever item has already been ruined or gone, that we're not Choshesh for. And therefore, our Mishnah states that you can use these items b'chazkat shehin kayamin. On the other hand, when you're going to do it in a manner that's retroactive, then we do fear Shema Yibaka node, and we don't want you setting up a situation in which you have to be Mafrish Trumot Masrot in such a manner. Now, my 8 by 8. What is this 8 by 8 here? The Gemara is asking the question, where did the 24 hours start, or what is the reference point for the 24 hours? Tosafot sees the question, not necessarily over the Gemara, but he himself asks the question is, what is the relevance of 8 by 8 over here of 24 hours? He says, we have such a concept in the Gemara Nidah, the first Mishnah Nidah says that a woman who is found to be a Nidah, she assumes for 24 hours retroactive to that, that she was already Tmeya. But over there, Tosafot discusses the reasons for that, why that is anchored in reasonability to assume that the woman knows or has hargashot when she becomes a nida, and therefore there is a limit to the extent which we would make her tmeya, but it's anchored around conceptually ideas about nida. Over here, what is the relevance of 24 hours? Why is it any more likely that the item disappeared 24 hours before, or less than 24 hours or more than 24 hours? What is the relevance of that time period? What you most likely have to say is that it's obvious that when the person shows up there, that it didn't just happen, because otherwise he would have been apprised of it earlier, or he would know that it just happened. The fact that he shows up there, we know for certain it just didn't happen. So we have to come up with an interval of time which we say the possibility of this happening was before. But that goes up against a chazaka that this item was there, and therefore Chazal picked an interval of time which is a normal interval, or a interval that is reasonable, and they came out with 8 to 8 to say that 24 hours is that period of time at which we can flip the chazaka a little bit, but on the other hand, not to be ridiculous and say that it just happened a moment ago, which we know is obviously not true. So now, Rabbi Yochanan Amar me'eit le'eit shel b'dika, the 24 hours here are 24 hours retroactively from the time that he found it, that it wasn't there anymore. So up until that point, everything is fine. The last 24 hours, anything that he was mafrish trumot masrot on and has yet to have eaten, he should be mafrish again, and he should make sure to be safek, take off trumot masrot, because it's very possible that this item was not there. Elazar ben Antigonus Omer, Mishum Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yanai, Me'eit le'eit shel hanacha. It's 24 hours after it was placed there, meaning that chazoka is only in place for the first 24 hours after he knew that it was there. But beyond that, we have no certainty about it. Tanan, so the Gemara brings our Mishnah to try to resolve between these two positions. Im abdu, or izeh choshesh meit leit. If they were lost, then you're choshesh 24 hours. Bishlam adam adamar meit leit shel b'dika shapir. According to one who says it means 24 hours from the time that he finds them missing, that makes sense. According to the second opinion, which we saw, that the 24 hours from the time that he left it there, he only has 24 hours of chazakah. It shouldn't be the way that the Mishnah expresses it, that chushesh mi eight le'eit, but rather it should be ad mi eight le'eit, mi boi le'eit. It should have said, until 24 hours after the hanacha, he is chushesh kashel. That is a serious question or refutation of that position, because the language in our Mishnah does not really support an understanding that we're talking about 24 hours of chazakah, but rather it seems that we're talking about 24 hours of chashasha, which aligns more with the position of Rabbi Yochanan, which is that the Me'et Le'et is 24 hours prior to the time that he found it missing. Divrei Rabbi Elazar. And our Mishnah has this being the opinion of Rabbi Elazar. So Amar Rabbi Elazar, as we've seen before, the Rabbi Elazar who's speaking here is the Amora Rabbi Elazar, second generation Amora in Eretz Yisrael, Talmid Chover of Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat. So Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat is speaking about the Tana Rabbi Elazar in our Mishnah, who speaks about this issue of Me'et Le'et. So Amar Rabbi Elazar, Chalukim Alav Chaverav of Rabbi Elazar. The fact that there's attribution in our Mishnah, that the opinion in our Mishnah is Rabbi Elazar, tells us that his peers argued on him. That's not. We have a Mishnah. Mikvesh Nimdad. If you have a Mikvah that was measured, V'nimsa Chaser, and then you find that it has less than the requisite 40 sa'ah to make it into a kosher Mikveh, Kol Tarot Shenasu Agabav L'mafreya. Any tarot that were done in this mikvah retroactively, ben b'shutei yachid, ben b'shutei rabim, tmeot. Whether they were done in the private domain or the public domain, they are tmeot. Meaning that we assume the way that we found the mikvah at this point in time is that it's chaser, and that is the way that it was all along, unless we know there's a certainty or a point at which we are certain that it did have the 40 sa'ah. From anything from that period forward until today, we assume that the mikvah was chaser. Now, there are a number of factors here. One is this idea, b'shuta yachid and b'shuta rabim. As we know from the Gemara and Sota, that safek tuma b'shuta yachid is tamei, safek tuma b'shuta rabim is tahor. So despite the fact that that is true, what the Mishnah over here says is, it is still tmeya here when the mikveh is found to be chaser. And that is for two reasons. The first of which is that the items have a cheskat tuma. They were definitely tmeim. And here we have now a safek as to whether the mikveh was kasher. So the fact that they were vadai tmeim and safek tehorim, that makes it that we will consider them to be tmeim because of that chazakah. In addition to that, as Rashi points out over here, the idea of the safek tuma here is different than the nature of the safek tuma that is mentioned in the Gemara and Sota with regards to Rishut Yachin and Rishut Rabim. Because over there, it's a safek maga. We're uncertain as to whether the item became tamei. And therefore, if we have that uncertainty in the Rishut HaYachid, we assume the item is Tameh. If we have that uncertainty in the Rishut HaRabim, we actually assume that the item is Tahor. Over here, we know that the items are Vadai Tahor. The Safek is whether they became Tahor now or not. So since they were Vadai Tmeim and a Safek Tahor, that is not covered by Safek Rishut HaYachid, Safek Rishut HaRabim. Rashi over here claims that the Rishut HaYachid and Rishut HaRabim deals with the location of the mikveh. And the question here is, despite the fact that this safek took place in Rishut Yachid, Rishut Rabim, meaning the placement, the location of the mikveh, it's irrelevant to the outcome of the halacha of this Mishnah. On the other hand, others suggest that the safek Rishut Yachid, Rishut Rabim here has to do where the object became tamei. Did it become tamei in Rishut Yachid, or did it become tamei in the Rishut Rabim? And then the placement of the mikveh is irrelevant to it becoming tahor. So now the Gemara says about that, pshita. What is Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat, the Amora, telling us? Obviously, from the Mishnah, it's a Mishnah Mefureshet that the Chachamim argue on Rabbi Elazar of our Mishnah. And so therefore, what is he adding for us in making that statement? Pshita de Chalukim. It's clear that they argue on him. Maudutema, what I would have thought, Maile Mafreya, when it's mentioned this Mishnah in Mikvaot, that all the Tarot that were done or placed in this Mikvah to become Tahor, that's people, objects that were made to hort to this mikveh are assumed to be tamei retroactively, I would have thought that the mafreya is me'et le'et for 24 hours, similar to the sheet of Rabbi Elazar in our Mishnah. Kamash Malan, that mafreya means literally retroactively until we have a point of certainty where the mikveh was full, and not just the 24 hours that are stated by Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Begimel Prakim, three times a year we check the barrels of wine to ensure that they haven't turned into vinegar or haven't gone bad. So Tano, Bikidum Shomotzei Chag Shel Tkufa. The only time that this applies is when immediately after Sukkot, and it's also already the tkufa. So as Rashi explains over here, it's only if the autumnal equinox has passed and we've entered into tkufat tishrei, meaning that the day after Sukkot is after September 20th or 21st when the autumnal equinox takes place. Now, as Tosfot points out, the Gemara tells us in other places, and the way that our calendar works today, there's no possibility that Sukkot will end before the beginning of Tkufat Tishrei, or the beginning of the fall season. And that is because the way our calendar is set up, it ensures, based on Sukkot has to fall out in the Chag HaSif, that at least one of the days of Sukkot will fall out during Tkufat Tishrei. So what the Gemara here makes it conditional on the fact that the day after Sukkot is after the autumnal equinox in the Tkufa of Tishrei in the fall season, that by definition will always be true. So what Tosafot notes is that in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, when it comes to creating a leap year or putting an extra month into the year, there are a number of factors that are taken into consideration. One of those factors is when Sukkot will fall out, what season it will fall out in. But he says that that is not enough of a reason by itself to create a leap year. It's what's called a snif leheter. It's an adjunct or an additional item to put together. If you're mitzarefit with another reason to make it a leap year, you would do that. And therefore, Tosafot says that there is a possibility that it will fall out, that Sukkot will not be in the fall season in the Tkufa of Tishrei, at least when they worked the calendar at Piaria and they did the Ibur HaShana based on a calculation each year. There is a possibility, if that was the only reason to make it into a leap year, that in that year the Chachamim would not have made it a leap year, and therefore Sukkot could have ended before the autumnal equinox. But again, in our calendar, that does not happen, and it will always be true. Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Begimel Prakim Mochrim Et HaTvua. The three times during the year where one sells the Tvua, Lifnei HaZera, Ubishat HaZera, Ubiprosa Pesach. That is, Lifnei HaZera is before the planting season, seemingly because then one is buying or purchasing the items to plant. Ubishat HaZera, Tosfot says it doesn't make so much sense that if you say that you do this right before you plant, and then you do it again while you're planting, it seems to be the exact same time, meaning that there's some sort of threshold here, but it's not far apart. And therefore, Tosafot says, Ubishat HaZera means after the period of time of planting. And therefore, there's before planting, and then after everybody is planted. So there's another season of buying then. And then the last one is Prosa Pesach, which is a terminology, pros, is defined in the Gemara of Pesachim as being half. Half of what? The Gemara of Pesachim and many of the Rishonim discuss the fact that pros means half the normal time that one prepares for a holiday. And since preparing for a holiday is 30 days, half of that would be either 15 days or 2 weeks prior to the holiday. So roughly around Rosh Chodesh Nisan, that would be the third time, which is, again, Pesach is Rosh Hashanah le'tvuah, and that would be the period of time when the harvest and people will be getting ready for the harvest. So that's another time period when people would normally purchase grains. So one before the planting season, one after the planting season when people realize how much they use for planting and then they need to fill in any deficits that they have either for the planting or for their storage or for usage over the winter period. And then again, after the winter is done, right before the harvest, when people are getting ready, they also planning for the summer period. That's another buying period. And then three times a year, you sell wine. Biprosa Pesach, again, 15 days before Pesach. Biprosa Tzeret, 15 days before Shavuot. Biprosa Chag, and 15 days before Sukkot. Here, seemingly, it's connected to the fact that people used the wine for Simchat Yom Tov, and therefore was a large part of the people's purchases coming into Yom Tov. And that would be the appropriate time, again, to have transactions take place because they were a large number of buyers at that period of time. The Shemen, and when it comes to oil, Me'atzeret Ve'elech. So oil, it comes from Shavuot. And onward, that is the period of time for Shemen. L'may Hilchoto. What is the halachic ramification of all these items? I mean, it's interesting. Sociologically, it's also interesting. But what halachic ramifications does it have? Samarova V'itemara Papa L'shutafin. It has to do with partners. The way Rashi explains partners over here is that generally partners have to get permission from the other partner to execute anything on behalf of the partnership, and they need the acquiescence of both partners in order to transact. Whereas in these three periods of time, one of the partners can act without the acquiescence or approval of the other partner to sell in that period, and then he cannot be held accountable for it. If he does that, and then the price goes up afterwards, and they should have waited, but because these are normal times to sell, then a partnership that is involved in any one of these items, since that is a normal and would be considered a person executing their fiduciary duty within the partnership to sell at that period of time, they won't be held accountable if something goes wrong. That's the way Rashi explains it. Tosafot here brings an alternative view based on the Rabbeinu Hananel and the Rabbeinu Tam, which is that normally partnerships, people can force the other party to stay in the partnership if they want to dissolve the partnership. These periods of time are natural periods of time for dissolution of partnerships. So if they're in a partnership to sell wine or to produce wine, or same thing with grains or shemen, these periods of time would be the natural periods to dissolve the partnership. And therefore, if one of the parties wants to dissolve the partnership, they can force the other party to dissolve the partnership at these periods of time. Outside of these periods of time, the other partner can force them to stay in the partnership until you reach these milestones. Mikam v'leilech mai. From that period forward, what is the din? Amarava koyoma pirkei hu. Every day is considered to be its time after you've crossed over these thresholds. So for Rashi, that means that you can sell at any point after you've crossed over these time periods. Or for Tosafot, you can dissolve the partnership anytime after this point. The Gemara now quotes a pasuk from Yonah that says, "Vahikiz ruach Hashemesh, when the sun rises, v'iman alukim ruach kadim charishit." And Hashem brought this easterly wind that was charashit. And the connection between these two pieces of the Gemara is that we spoke about kidum of Motzeach Chag, and over here we're talking about the Ruach Kadim, and that is the progression of the Gemara into this next stage. The Gemara wants to know what's the meaning of the word Maicharashit. Amar Rav Yehuda, Bishash min Hashevet Oseh Telamim Telamim Bayam, that it is such a strong wind that when it blows, it causes waves and waves. It literally, Telamim means furrows that are used in plowing of the field, but here it means furrows in the sea, which is equivalent of large waves in the sea from the power of such a wind. The Gemara says about that, Amalei Rabboi Hachi, Hainu Dichtiv, Atach HaShemesh Al Rosh Yonav Italeif. Then how do you explain the continuation of the story there, which is that the sun was beating down hard on the head of Yonah, Italeif, and then he faints? The way that you're describing here, it's a powerful wind that is bringing, in a sense, coolness along with it. Well, how does that reconcile with the continuation of the story that the sun beats down on Yonah and causes him to faint? El Amar Rabbo, so now you've misinterpreted the word Harishit to mean Harisha, the plowing, and that's why you came up with this description of the waves and the strong easterly wind, but rather the word Harishit also can come a word Cheresh, which means to silence. And that's what Rabbo says, V'shash min ha-shevet mishateket kol aruchot mipaneha, that when this wind blows, it silences all the other winds that come along. Meaning it's not that it's a very strong wind, but it's a wind that eliminates all the other winds from having their normal influence over the environment or the weather. And that's what is meant, v'hainu dichtiv, and that's what meant in the pasuk in Iyov, asher bigadecha chamim v'ashkeit eretz midarom, that your clothing is very hot, meaning that you're feeling the heat, v'ashkeit eretz, because things were silenced midarom, from the south. And as Rashi explains over here, the fact that it mentions the south, it's not because the southerly wind is what does this, but rather this easterly wind silences the effect that the southerly wind normally has. And as Rashi notes over here, that the north southerly wind usually cools off and brings cooler climate. And if you have this easterly wind come and push it away or negate or mitigate the effects of the southerly wind, the southerly wind is silenced, and because the southerly wind is silenced, that's why it's so hot. And that's what it's meant there, that it was a Ruach Kadim Harishit. It was a very strong easterly wind that took out the effect of all the other winds, and that is corroborated by this pasuk in Iyov that says that when the Darom, when the southerly wind is silenced, then it's extremely hot. Now, as Tosko points out, that the original assumption that the Ruach Kadim is a strong wind is not negated by this explanation. It's just that what is the impact of that strong wind? It's not what we thought, that the strong wind comes and brings cooling weather or milder weather with it, but rather it's a stronger wind that knocks out the impact of the other winds. When is it hot? When are your clothes hot? That is when it has been silenced from the southern side. Because when it blows, it silences all the other winds that are around it, meaning that it eliminates the normal impact of the other winds. Others suggest here that we're talking about the southerly wind, which is a very dry, hot wind that comes up from the midbar. And the reason it's called kadim is because of the strength of the wind. And therefore, the meaning here is not the easterly wind that pushes away the other winds, but rather the southerly wind that pushes away the other winds. And as we go through the Gemara, you'll see that both of those possibilities exist in the interpretation of the Gemara.
Rav Chista
were sitting together. Chalef Azel Gneva Alayhu. Gneva, one of the Chachamim, passed by him. His name will be familiar because we saw him earlier in the Masechta with regards to his altercations with Mar Ukva, who was having a very difficult time for him and wanted to turn him over to the Malchut. So as over here, Gneva is a very controversial character. He is definitely a Talmud Chacham, but on the other hand, his behavior is somewhat suspect, and he was extremely bellicose, antagonistic, argumentative, and for that reason gave Mar Ukva a very hard time. But seemingly it wasn't Mar Ukva alone that he had these issues with, because we're going to see here in this story that they have mixed feelings about this Gneva. Amar Chad HaChavrei, one of them here of the Amoraim, Rav Huna and Rav Chista, one of them said to the other, Nikum Mikameh, the Bar Oriayin Hu. Let us stand up for him because he is a Talmud Chacham. Amal Idach Mikameh Palgo Niko. We're going to get up for someone who is a Bar Machloket, who's extremely antagonistic, someone who always engages in discord and disagreement and is extremely argumentative. They're not going to get up for him. Adacha ata ihu gabayu. In the interim, while they were discussing this issue, Gneva reached them. Amaluhu, he said to them, Bamaya Siktitu, what are you guys engaged in? As if to imply the reason that they didn't stand up for him was because they were engaged in discussing Torah. And so he says, what are you guys discussing? Amalei Beruchot, we were discussing the winds. Amalu, Haki Amar Rav Chanan Barova Amarav. Dalid ruchot min ashvot b'chol yom. Every day, the four winds from the different directions of the world blow. Ruach tzvonit min ashevet im kulam. And the northerly wind is joined together with all of the other winds. Shimalei kein en olam mitkayem. Tafilu sha'achat. If it wasn't for the fact that the northerly wind was joined in with the other winds, the world would not last tafilu sha'achat, even for a moment. And as Rashi explains over here, that the northerly wind is a very calm and pleasant wind. It's not too hot, not too cold, and it's mimateket. It sweetens the other wind, or its contribution is to mitigate the negative impacts of the other winds. Ruach dromit kashem mikulan. The southerly wind is the most difficult of them all. V'ilam malei ben nates. If it wasn't for the ben nates here, which refers to the son of the hawk, which Rashi describes here as some sort of malach or sar that is in charge of the ruchot, Mamida, he holds it back. Mecharevet kol olam kulo mipana. It would destroy the whole world. As Rashi describes over here, based on what we're going to see in the Psukim in a second from Iyov, is that this malach stretches out his wings in order to slow or shield, diminish the impact of the southerly wind. And that's what allows the world to survive, because he shields the world from the southerly wind, diminishes the impact of the southerly wind by spreading his wings and capturing it before it hits the world. Shenemar. Hamivinatcha ya'aver netz ifroz kinafav v'teiman. Was it you? And again, Hashem here is talking to Eov that had the wisdom and was the one who had the understanding to create the whole world. Are you the one who caused the hawk to grow its pinions, to have its wings stretched out v'teiman to the south? And in expressing this, spreading out its wings to the south, that's where they get this garak drasha, that he prevents the southerly wind from coming and causing difficulty to the world. Rav Rav Nachman by Yitzchak HaViyatve. Rav Rav Nachman were sitting. Havachalif Azil Rav Nachman by Yaakov. Rav Nachman Yaakov was passing by. The Yotiv Biguharko the Dahava. He was sitting in a golden chariot, something that was usually used for people of royalty or of political clout. Upari Saleh Sarvala de Karte. And he had on him some sort of cloak of karte, which is like a bluish green color, but again, colors of someone of import or royalty. Rava Azal Gabay, Rava jumped up to go speak to him. Rav Nachman Yitzchak lo Azal Gabay. On the other hand, Rav Nachman Yitzchak did not go to greet him. Amar Dilma Miinshe de Beirish Galuta Ninho. Maybe they are an important person that came from the house of the exilarch. Rava Tzarech Lahu. Rava needs their help, and therefore he approached them and he went to speak to them. I don't need them. So here is a major machloket Rashi and Tosafot as to which Rav Nachman we are speaking about. But the general picture here is that this Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov, who's in this golden chariot, obviously carries political clout and has the ability to help out individuals. Rava is the leader of a large city, and he is involved in the public at large, and therefore he needs both the good graces of the House of the Exilarch, as well as maybe to petition on behalf of, whether it's his Talmidim, his subjects, or his city, to get help from them. And therefore Rava jumps out to go speak to him. On the other hand, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak did not go to him, because he did not need him. Rashi claims over here, Rav Nachman Yitzchak didn't need him, because this is Rav Nachman Stam in Shas. And Rav Nachman Stam in Shas, we know, was Chatnei de Reish Galuta, that he was a son-in-law to the Reish Galuta, and therefore he had political clout, and he did not need to go seek it from Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov. And that's why Rashi says Rav Nachman Yitzchak remained seated. On the other hand, Tosafot disagrees with Rashi and says that Stam Rav Nachman in Shas is actually Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov, and he proves that by showing that Rav Nachman's name is never mentioned plain along with Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov. He does show that other places in Shas, we do find Rav Nachman Stam together with Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, and therefore it can't be that Rav Nachman is Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. And therefore Tosafot says that Rav Nachman Yaakov is connected to the Reish Galuta, as we know, because he's Stam Rav Nachman throughout Shas. But then you have to explain, why did Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak not get up over here? So Tosafot claims that he was an Ashir Haya, that he was very wealthy, and he had no need for the House of the Exilarch. He was independently wealthy, had independent political clout, and therefore he didn't need the Reish Galuta to help him out, whether that's because he was less involved with the Tzibur than Rava, or because of his personal wealth, that he didn't have that necessity, and that explains what happened over here. Kedechazer Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov, of Azil the Gabay. So when Rav Nachman Yitzchak realized that it was Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov who was a Talmud Chacham, he went ahead and he approached him, because again, before he thought it was just someone of political clout, now he realized it's also someone who is a Talmud Chacham. Then, Galil the Darei, when he saw Rav Nachman Yaakov, he happened to be rolling up his sleeves because he was extremely hot. Mar, he said, Shadya Noshi, that the wind that is called Shadya is blowing now. It's super hot, and that's why I'm feeling this way. As Tosafot points out, that even though the Ruach Dromit, the southerly wind, is called Shadya, over here, that's not what the meaning of the word is, but Shadya over here refers to the easterly wind, which we saw before from the Psukim in Yonah, is the one that brings this tremendous heat. And so therefore, Rav Nachman Yaakov was describing his discomfort or having to roll up his sleeves because he was so hot. It must be coming because of this easterly wind that was blowing. On the other hand, some people take it literally and say that the Shadya Noshi over here was the southerly wind. That southerly wind that we were discussing before, which is destructive and extremely hot, that's what they were referring to over here, was this southerly wind that was blowing. Amarova, hachi amar Rav. This is what Rav says. Isha mapelet bo. That type of wind is so destructive that it causes women to miscarry. Shmuel amar afilu margalit shbiyam merakevet. That even a pearl in the sea rots from this. Rabbi Yochanan amar afilu shechvat zer shbein isham misarechet bo. And even the semen that is found within the woman rots from this, and that's within the first 3 days where the semen is still viable and can impregnate the woman, that goes bad in these conditions. Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Ushlota Mikra Achad Darshu. All three of these Amoraim who are describing this phenomenon that is associated with this hot wind, they all were Doresh this Pasuk, because it says, Kihu Ben Achim Yafri, he will amongst the reeds flourish, Yavo Kadim Ruach Hashem Midbar, that easterly wind will come from the Midbar, and that gives you the two options here, whether it's Ruach Kadim is the easterly wind, or Midbar, which is in the south of Israel, that was the southern wind, Oleh, comes up, Yavosh Mikoro, it dries out its Mikor, usually in Chazal, the word Mikor is to reference the uterus, and that's what it means here, Chazal are saying, Yavosh Mikoro, Zu Mikora Shalisha, that refers to the uterus of the woman, and that's what causes the miscarriage, Ve'yacharav Mayano, Ze Shichvat Zera, Shebimeisha, that it destroys or wipes out the Mayan, all the springs. The spring is a reference to the Shichvat Zera, to the semen of the man that is inside the woman. Who, Yiseh Utsar Kol Kli Chemda, it will tear apart that all that is in the storehouses, all that is precious in the storehouses. Zu Margalit Shebiyam, these are the pearls of the sea. Amarava, Adei Sorahu, the Daiki cry, that this interpretation of the pasuk comes from those from Surah who are midayek in the krah for these types of items. So then the Gemara says, well, if you're already interpreting the pasuk that way, what do we do with the first part of the pasuk? Mai ki hu ben achim yafri, that it is amongst the reeds, it will flourish. What does that have to do with this hot wind that comes? Amrava afilu shufta bikuvina demora. Even the stick that goes into the hoe, means the handle of the hoe that goes into the hoe, when you take the wood and you jam it into the metallic part that holds the hoe together, that's a machloket, the Rashi and Tosafot exactly how to explain this in the Gemara and Shabbat with regards to the malach over there. But Rashi, the Shittato, says that it's talking about the Beit Yad, it's talking about the handle that is being placed into the hoe, that's usually placed in there tight so that you can do the work, whether it's nailed in there or held in there because it's squeezed in tight, so that you can use the handle to move the metallic piece, which is the hoe, Rafio. That gets weakened by this wind, meaning the dryness causes it to shrink, and that dryness makes it that it's now loose inside of the handle, inside of the hoe. Yosef Amar, afilu sikta bedafna rafio, even a peg that is in the wall, wooden peg in the wall, becomes loose. So all of these are using the words of benachim, things that are partners. Partners are either because they're normally together, so the handle of the hoe is together with the hoe, the peg is normally inserted into the wall. All of those are yafri, instead of the word yafri, to flourish, they're using a play on the word rafio, that they become loose or weakened. Even the reeds that are weaved into the basket become loosened, meaning that they dry out and they shrink. If you ever made a basket from the leaves of the lulav, when you put them in, they're moist. But then over time, then they dry out and they shrink. So similar here, they shrink and therefore they become loose in the basket. Okay, with that, we finish up the third perek. Hadron Allah, kol haget.